Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 1168, Biopsyop Apocalypse Now, part 24, A Pound of Cure, part 3. This is being recorded on December 11th of the year 2020. We are going to plunge right in and continue to take a look at not only the vaccines that are in development, but in particular for the COVID-19 pandemic, but the forces behind those vaccines. We're going to recap some of the information that we looked at in our last program about the very real possibility, I believe it is a very strong probability, that in fact the IG Farben successor complex of the deadly Bormann organization, the element that I feel will prove to be the decisive element in human affairs, is behind the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine. We took a look at that last week, and I will review briefly the information that we looked at and continue with analysis of the functional intersection and symbiosis between the massive, decisively powerful IG Farben company and its successor firms and the Bormann Flight Capital Organization. Before, however, we get into discussion of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine and the Bormann Group, actually before even talking about an article that has, or a consideration that has come up in connection with the vaccines, I am not at all unmindful of what is going on. Even Republican politicians are being threatened. The Secretary of State of the state of Michigan was reading to her four-year-old son, reading Christmas stories to her four-year-old son, while an armed group, I don't know how many were in there, but an armed group slash mob was outside chanting obscenities and openly threatening her, and her four-year-old son could hear that. Republican officials in various states who do not go along with the Trump party line are being openly threatened. In fact, one Pennsylvania official said that if she did not move to ally herself with the forces looking to overturn the electoral results, the presidential electoral results in Pennsylvania, that her house would have been bombed. In one sense, well, it's appalling, but I really can't say past the point that I'm all that surprised. What is happening is that the violence that manifested itself in Dealey Plaza on Dallas, Texas, in Dallas, Texas, on November 22nd of 1963 has now spread, and the disease of political murder has now reached a pandemic in the U.S. It is not in any way separate from the pandemic as a whole. Before I will be talking about that, I probably should interrupt the Biopsyop Apocalypse series to talk about what really might be termed Dealey Plaza Nation, and it sort of is. That is what that has become. But in the coverage of the virus, I think before I even get to the most important part of this, which is the wealth concentration virus, because it is that, and this pandemic has absolutely been planned from the get-go. Talking about what, for lack of a better term, could be called walking the coronavirus, because the serpent's walk scenario that I have engaged in, we have examined so many times, not only involves a Nazi takeover of the U.S., but it takes place after the SS go underground, which we know they did, build up their capital muscle, their economic muscle, which we know they did, buy into the opinion-forming media, which they have done, we'll review that, and after the U.S., is devastated by a biological warfare attack involving something called PACO, standing for Pandemic Communicable Virus. Martial law is declared, and the underground Reich, which has infiltrated the military, takes over. We'll talk more about that in the future, in the immediate future. I think maybe we'll talk about walking the coronavirus before we even get into the wealth concentration virus. But what we are looking at is in no size, shape, form, or manner separate from the mobs calling for the death of even Republican officials, openly threatening people, and what really amounts to a political insurrection by the Trump forces. It is interesting, and many people have noted this, that they are absolutely suggesting in no uncertain terms that there was massive electoral fraud, and yet the success of down-ballot Republicans is not being questioned at all by those people. So that, however, is a rational consideration, and what we are looking at is not rational at all. Before we get into a review of the BioNTech and IG Farben connecting evidentiary tributaries, we're going to take a look at a development that I had not really considered. I was not aware of this. It has been covered by a number of media voices, including the print edition, the Western print edition of the New York Times of this past Wednesday, December 9th. Of the year 2020. This is a story by Apoorva, APOORVA, Mandavili, MANDAVILLI. It is subheaded Silent Spreaders. A vaccine protects you, but what about others? That's where masks enter. And this lays the consideration that some of the vaccines, such as the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, which has now been approved for use in Canada and has been given the green light slash thumbs up by an FDA panel, it would appear to be stealing a march in terms of applicability on the Moderna vaccine. But the article that I'm about to excerpt notes that the vaccines may prevent people from getting sick with COVID-19, but they may not necessarily protect those people from being infected by the virus. They will remain healthy, and then healthy but asymptomatic, they might spread that virus to other people. That is not something I have really considered, but we're going to take a look at some of those very same issues right now. Again, a vaccine protects you, but what about others? That's where masks enter from the Wednesday, December 9th of 2020, Western edition of the New York Times. The new COVID-19 vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna seem to be remarkably good at preventing serious illness. But it is unclear how well they will curb the spread of the coronavirus. That is because the Pfizer and Moderna trials tracked only how many vaccinated people became sick with COVID-19. That leaves open the possibility that some vaccinated people get infected without developing symptoms and could then silently transmit the virus, especially if they come in close contact with others or stop wearing masks. If vaccinated people are silent spreaders of the virus, they may keep it circulating in their communities, putting unvaccinated people at risk. Quote, a lot of people are thinking that once they get vaccinated, they're not going to have to wear masks anymore, said Michael Tall, Tall, immunologist at Stanford University. It's really going to be critical for them to know if they have to keep wearing masks because they could still be contagious, unquote. In most respiratory infections, including the new coronavirus, the nose is the main port of entry. The virus rapidly multiplies there, jolting the immune system to produce a type of antibodies that are specific to mucosa, the moist tissue lining the nose, mouth, lungs, and stomach. If the same person is exposed to the virus a second time, those antibodies, as well as immune cells that remember the virus, rapidly shut down the virus in the nose before it gets a chance to take hold elsewhere in the body. The coronavirus vaccines, in contrast, are injected deep into the muscles and quickly absorb into the blood, where they stimulate the immune system to produce antibodies. This appears to be enough protection to keep the vaccinated person from getting ill. Some of those antibodies will circulate to the nasal mucosa and stand guard there, but it is not clear how much of the antibody pool can be mobilized or how quickly. If the answer is not much, then viruses could bloom in the nose and be sneezed or breathed out to infect others. Quote, It is a race. It depends on whether the virus can replicate faster or the immune system can control it faster, said Marion Pepper, an immunologist at the University of Washington in Seattle. It is really an important question. That is why mucosal vaccines, like the nasal spray flu mist or the oral polio vaccine, are better than intramuscular injections at fending off respiratory viruses, experts said. The next generation of coronavirus vaccines may elicit immunity in the nose and the rest of the respiratory tract where it is most needed. Or people could get an intramuscular injection followed by a mucosal boost that produces protective antibodies in the nose and throat. Quote, preventing severe disease is easiest. Preventing mild disease is harder. And preventing all infections is the hardest, unquote, said Deepta Bhattacharya, B-A-T-T-A-C-H-A-R-Y-A, an immunologist at the University of Arizona. Quote, if it is 95% effective at preventing symptomatic disease, it's going to be something less than that in preventing all infections, for sure, unquote. Still, he and other experts said they were optimistic that the vaccines would suppress the virus enough, even in the nose and throat, to prevent immunized people from spreading it to others. Skipping down. But some studies have suggested that even people with no symptoms can have high amounts of coronavirus in their nose, noted Dr. Yvonne Maldonado, who represents the American Academy of Pediatrics at meetings of the Federal Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. The first person confirmed to be reinfected with the coronavirus, a 33-year-old man in Hong Kong, also did not have symptoms, but harbored enough virus to infect others. Vaccinated people who have a high viral load but don't have symptoms, quote, would actually be in some ways even worse spreaders because they may be under a false sense of security, unquote, Dr. Maldonado said. One more time. Vaccinated people who have a high viral load but don't have symptoms, quote, would actually be in some ways even worse spreaders because they may be under a false sense of security, Dr. Maldonado said. So that is something else to take into consideration. And again, remember that A, no vaccine has been approved for human use until something like 4 or 5 years of trials have taken place. And these are proceeding at Operation Warp Speed. Also, the results that have been announced, for example, for some of the drugs, like remdesivir, have been gamed, frankly, by the regulatory authorities. And I would also note that, the results that have been reported are from press releases, not from peer-reviewed, rigorous studies. Also, the very speed with which the vaccines have been developed and are now being brought to market obviously precludes any long-term negative effects. We'll see if those turn out to be the case. But it is interesting, and I had not envisioned something like that, and my guess is a lot of other people won't either. If the vaccine, if someone has taken the vaccine and it has kept them from getting sick, they might still be capable of spreading the vaccine. So that could seriously muddy the waters. Now, we have been looking at the Pfizer-Moderna vaccine that has been, not the Pfizer, Moderna, but the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine that has been brought to market and has now been approved in both the UK and also in Canada, and it has been approved by an FDA panel here in the U.S., and very much looks as though it will get emergency approval here. The Pfizer, a pharmacological giant, is paired with a German biotech company called BioNTech, that's capital B-I-O, capital N, capital T-E-C-H, which was started by two Turkish gastarbeiter doctors. That's incorrect. Usually they are the offspring of Turkish gastarbeiter. There are a large number of Turkish guest workers in Germany. And Ugur Sahin, probably mispronouncing that, U-G-U-R-S-A-H-I-N, and Özlem Tureci, O-Z-L-E-M, T-U-R-E-C-I, a pair of doctors who are married, started the company called Ganymede and later BioNTech. The key with regard to Ganymede or Ganymed, G-A-N-Y-M-E-D, is where they got the money. A major investor in Ganymede, it would appear that they were the major source of venture capital, are the Strungmann brothers. That's Thomas and Andreas Strungmann. You'll see that S-T-R-U-N-G-M-A-N-N or S-T-R-U-E-N-G-M-A-N-N. They are a pair of identical twins, and they are titans in the German biotech scene. They began their entrepreneurial career with a company called Hexal AG, which became one of the leaders in developing generic drugs for the German market. And I believe it was Andreas had begun his medical work in the bush in South Africa under the apartheid regime, and one of the very first foreign investments for Hexal AG was in South Africa at the very end of the apartheid regime. As we have seen in numerous programs, the apartheid regime under the Bruderbond and the National Party was a direct offshoot of the Third Reich. Now, eventually, Ganymede was, Hexal, I should say, was sold to Novartis. That is the company that grew out of the Swiss component of IG Farben. It is composed of Sandoz, Geigy AG, and CIBA, C-I-B-A. I may be mispronouncing those. Those three companies comprised the Swiss component of IG Farben in the pre-World War II and World War II period. They then combined into one pharmaceutical giant, Novartis, after the war. They purchased Hexal, giving the Strungmann brothers an enormous block of capital. Their Santo Holding is the principal investor in BioNTech. And BioNTech, I would note, purchased a state-of-the-art facility in Marburg, Germany, from the very same aforementioned Novartis, basically the Swiss component of the former IG Farben. And again, Santo Holding of the Strumann Brothers appears to be, it is the basic, the largest single investor in BioNTech, and they were also heavily involved in Ganymede, which was sold to a Japanese company for a large sum of money. The capitalization of BioNTech has soared. It was valued at about $3.4 billion. $3.4 billion, and a year ago, and now it is up to roughly $25 billion, and that was as of November. Probably a lot more than that now. The stock had risen 219% as of November of this year. So BioNTech, which along with Pfizer is the leader at this point in getting their vaccine to market, is an enormous cash cow. Now, in our last program, we also looked at the Strumann Brothers. And Thomas Strumann was a key member of the board of directors of Wacker Chemie. Wacker Chemie developed FUM, a pair of IG Farben companies. Alexander Wacker, and actually I haven't got the names. They are in the book. I haven't got the names right in front of me. I'm operating from memory here. But in the book, Germany's Master Plan, The Story of an Industrial Offensive by Joseph Borken and Charles A. Welch, available for download for free in the SpitfireList.com books section. The two Wacker companies, one, I think it's Dr. Peter Wacker, GmbH, and the other is Wacker AG. They were key components of IG Farben and Wacker Chemie, on which Thomas Strumann was a key director, also appears to be a direct evolutionary entity of IG Farben. We took a look at a Handelsblatt article in which Wacker Chemie was seen to have had a Nazi past. Wacker Chemie was, for up until 2006, 51% owned by the Wacker family and 49% opened by Hoechst, that's H-O-E-C-H-S-T's division of Sanofi, a French pharmaceutical company. As we will see, Hoechst, along with BASF and Bayer, were the three large successor companies to IG Farben and were owned and controlled by the very same interests. Eventually, Thomas Strumann was replaced on the board of Wacker Chemie by Anne Sophie Wacker, an actual member of the Wacker family. This might appear to be unintelligible or a reach to the uninitiated. I can appreciate that. But the consummately important dominance of IG Farben, not only in the world's chemical and pharmaceutical businesses, but their link to the deadly Bormann organization, literally the economic and political component of a Third Reich gone underground, is paramount in assessing not only the industrial, business, and financial landscape of the contemporary world, but understanding the evolution of that business and that business landscape, both the industrial and financial components. Another of the books available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website is the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, offered by Paul Manning and published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, Incorporated. Initially, Paul Manning, who was part of the CBS crew that covered World War II for the Columbia Broadcast System, he broadcast the surrenders of both Germany and Japan on the CBS radio network, trained and and fought as a gunner aboard B-17s and B-24s so he could cover the air raids over Western Europe during World War II. And CBS, at the urging of Edward R. Murrow, a close friend and professional colleague of Paul Manning, underwrote Paul Manning's research into the Borman organization, but eventually pressure from that consummately powerful organization blocked any coverage by CBS of the Borman network. In Martin Borman, Nazi in Exile, there is an excellent account of the very close partnership of Reichsleiter Martin Borman and I.G. Farben, in particular, Hermann Schmitz, also Dr. Georg von Schnitzler, S-C-H-N-I-T-Z-L-E-R, also conferred very closely with Borman. The Borman Group set up 750 corporate fronts in neutral nations around the world as capital repositories for the capital of the Third Reich, and those were partnered with the various branches of major German industrial firms, including and especially I.G. Farben. A major element that we will talk about is the Berlin NW7 office. That was the global financial espionage branch of I.G. Farben. So in evaluating BioNTech, which along with their corporate partner Pfizer would appear to be out in front, if this were a horse race, they are out in front of the other contestants for the vaccine for COVID-19. And the available evidence suggests that they have evolved from the consummately powerful IG Farben complex. Turning to Martin Borman, Nazi in Exile, we read about I.G. Farben and their relationship with the Borman Network as follows. I.G. Farben was a formidable ally for Reichsleiter Borman in his plans for the post-war economic rebirth of Germany. In a telephone conversation with Dr. von Schnitzler, Borman asked what would the loss of factories in France and the other occupied countries mean to German industry in general, and to IG in particular. Dr. von Schnitzler said he believed the technical dependence of these countries on IG would be so great that despite German defeat, IG, in one way or another, could regain its position of control of the European chemical business. Quote, "They will need the constant technical help of IG's scientific laboratories as they do not own appropriate installations within themselves," unquote. And later, in assessing what treatment would be meted out to IG Farben by the victorious allies, Borman, Reichsleiter Borman, conferred with Hermann Schmitz, who greatly assisted the flight capital program and later apparently folded the very powerful and lucrative Schmitz Trust into the Borman network. Reichsleiter Borman asked Schmitz his views of the future. Schmitz replied, quote, "The occupation armies will be understanding in the West, but certainly not in the East. I have instructed all Farben administrators and technicians to come to the West, where they can be of use in resuming our operations once the disturbances of 1945 come to a halt," unquote. Schmitz added that while general bomb damage to the IG plants was about 25% of capacity, some were untouched. He mentioned speaking with Field Marshal Mobel, M-O-V-E-L, who was commanding the defenses of the Ruhr, quote, "Mobil had planned to turn our Bayer Leverkusen pharmaceutical factory into an artillery base, but he agreed to make it an open, undefended factory. Hopefully, we will get it back untouched," unquote. What about your board of directors and the essential executives? If they are held by the occupation authorities, can IG continue? Borman asked, and Schmitz replied, quote, "We can continue. We have an operational plan for just such a contingency, which everyone understands. However, I don't believe our board members will be detained too long, nor will I. but we must go through a procedure of investigation before release, so I have been told by our NW7 people who have excellent contacts in Washington, unquote. Farben's elaborate infrastructure, Again, a note here, before we leave this excerpt, we must go through a procedure of investigation before release, so I have been told by our NW7 people who have excellent contacts in Washington. That is the aforementioned Berlin NW7 office, which we will read more about right now. Speaking of that, this, too, reported to Martin Bormann. I.G. Farben's NW7 office in Berlin compiled military and economic data on all countries for the Wehrmacht. This department was staffed with men of recognized ability in all branches of business and science. It was under the direction of Dr. Max Ilgner, ILGNER, nephew of Hermann Schmitz, IG's president, who was known throughout the industrial world as, quote, the master of financial camouflage, unquote. Farben had offices and representatives in 93 countries, when no social gathering of businessmen was too small to be covered by an NW7 representative, whose reports on market conditions, factory installations, raw material supplies, and research were transmitted immediately to Berlin and Dr. Ilgner. In the United States, NW7 operated through the firm of Chemnico, capital C-H-E-M-N-Y-C-O, Incorporated, an American-formed subsidiary. Chemnico sent tremendous amounts of information ranging from photographs and blueprints to detailed descriptions of entire industrial complexes and secret processes. And we're going to read still more about the NW7 office, and note the reference here to the Ausland organization. We'll get back to that this or a following excerpt. The AO was basically the Nazi party in overseas countries, and it was very strongly connected with the Berlin NW7 office. This huge organization functioned as a manufacturing and research arm of the German government, with the responsibility of discovering all possible means of increasing the military power of Germany. More than 4.25 billion Reichsmarks were invested in new plants, mines, and power installations, with other millions going into new research facilities. So close had Farben become to the government that IG Farben always knew in advance all invasions planned by Hitler. It was to supply the materials necessary to each conquest, and when a land had been overrun and subjugated, the Farben experts would handle the consolidation and organization of the industrial facilities as additional supply sources for the German armed forces. As German troops swept across Europe and Hitler proclaimed his vision of a 1,000-year Third Reich, IG Farben also dreamed of world empire. This was outlined with clarity in a document called Neue Ordnung, or New Order, that was accompanied by a letter of transmittal to the Ministry of Economics. It declared that a new order for the chemical industry of the world should supplement Hitler's new order. Therefore, the document stated, Farben was fitting future industrial plans into such a framework. IG Farben was the major chemical firm on the continent, and as each country fell to Germany, its acquisitions of chemical and dyestuff companies were enormous. IG also increased its investments in these by 7 billion Reichsmarks. One more time, the role of IG Farben in the European and global chemical industries is fundamental. So reviewing this briefly, This was outlined with clarity. I've been talking about I.G. Farben's Dreams of World Industrial Empire. This was outlined with clarity in a document called Neue Ordnung or New Order that was accompanied by a letter of transmittal to the Ministry of Economics. It declared that a new order for the chemical industry of the world would supplement Hitler's new order. Therefore, the document stated, Farben was fitting future industrial plans into such a framework. I.G. Farben was the major chemical firm on the continent, and as each country fell to Germany, its acquisitions of chemical and Baustoff companies were enormous. I.G. also increased its investments in these by 7 billion Reichsmarks. The close relationship of Farben to the Third Reich leadership was underscored in other ways as well. IG's leading officials assisted in formulation and execution of economic policies of government. Its president was a member of the Reichstag. Its leading scientist was a chief assistant to Hermann Göring under the four-year plan. Its statisticians and economists prepared intelligence for the Nazi high command. Scores of its technicians were at any given time on loan to the air and war ministries. The contact men of NW7 throughout the world were called the IG Verbindungsmammer, the liaison officers between Farben back in Germany and the branches elsewhere. These IG Verbindungsmammer, as well as all other key Farben representatives working beyond the borders of the Third Reich, were members of the National Socialist German Workers' Party. So now Martin Bormann had at his command not only the Ausland Organisation, or AO, but also the IG Verbindungsmammer of Farben, which could be counted on to heed his orders when it was time to disperse the commercial assets of the Third Reich. In testimony later given to Nuremberg investigators, Hermann Schmitz, the president of IG Farben, praised Bormann for the way he had directed the distribution of German assets around the world. His own Farben organization had, of course, contributed to the success of the operation. Every regional representative working for Hermann Schmitz was an exceptional businessman, or he would not have been with IG. All had contributed sound advice in their areas of competence, the regions of the world where they represented Farben while keeping an eye on the subsidiaries of the parent concern, and the 700 hidden corporations they controlled. They had provided assistance and continuing guidance in establishing the 750 new companies created on order of Bormann, who wanted more than hidden assets. Bormann wanted the money and patents and technicians put to work to create even greater assets that would bolster Germany in the post-war years. As we'll see, that will happen. In their meeting in the Chancellery, both men checked over the figures of sums dispersed, and they were accurate to the penny. Powerful friends of the Bormann organization in all Western countries, including those sprinkled in control points throughout the administration in Washington and in the financial and brokerage businesses of Wall Street, the City of London, and the Paris establishment, did not wish a coordinated drive to get at these external German assets. They had understandable reasons if you overlook morality. The financial benefits of cooperation, collaboration had been an old hat term with the war winding down, were very enticing depending on one's importance and ability to be of service to the organization and the 750 corporations they were secretly manipulating, to say nothing of the known multinationals such as IG Farben. At the beginning again. They had understandable reasons if you overlook morality. The financial benefits for cooperation, collaboration had become an old hat term with the war winding down, were very enticing depending on one's importance and ability to be of service to the organization and the 750 corporations they were secretly manipulating, to say nothing of the known multinationals such as IG Farben, Thyssen AG, and Siemens, and as a second reason, the philosophy of free enterprise and preservation of private property. And before continuing, in the books for download section of the SpitfireList.com website, there are books talking about IG Farben and how the post-war international cartel structure was maintained. And basically that is fundamental in understanding why the Wacker/Strumann/BioNTech connection is so important. The cartel system of which IG Farben was arguably perhaps the dominant element that was kept in place. And basically the Bormann Group, the Berlin Mob, I guess one could say if this were an organized crime syndicate, the Berlin Mob has replaced the Washington Gang and the London Syndicate as the dominant element in this transnational corporate global network. IG Farben itself was technically broken up. By the way, before going into this, some of the key books to read in the books for download section, there is a link to the online edition of The Crime and Punishment of IG Farben by Joseph Borkin, the book Treason's Peace by Howard Watson Armbruster, the book The Devil's Chemists by Josiah Du Bois, the book All Honorable Men by James Stewart Martin, the aforementioned Germany's Master Plan, The Story of an Industrial Offensive by Joseph Borkin and Charles A. Welch, and also this book here, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, talk about that preservation. IG was technically broken up into three companies, Hoechst, H-O-E-C-H-S-T, now part of Sanofi, and it is the Hoechst division of Sanofi, a French pharmaceutical industry that had 49% of Wacker Chemie, along with the 51% owned by the Wacker family, who were directly evolved from IG Farben subsidiaries. By 1956, the three multinationals, Hoechst, BASF, and Bayer, reshaped from the 159 companies within Germany that had comprised IG Farben, were generating record profits for the original 450 major Farben stockholders, who had organized themselves into the IG Farben Stockholders Protective Committee in Bonn. The Big Three went on expanding, tripling capitalization in 1956 from investment funds that poured in from the interlocking companies established in safe haven countries by Martin Bormann and Hermann Schmitz. There was a return more vigorous than ever of the huge, monolithic industrial multinationals that dominated the German economy before and during World War II. Each of these three spin-offs, Hoechst, BASF, and Bayer from IG Farben today, does more business individually than did Farben at its zenith when its corporate structure covered 93 countries. BASF and Bayer individually boast worldwide sales of nearly $10 billion annually, while Hoechst, now the world's largest chemical company, generated $16.01 billion in worldwide sales in 1980. By the way, this book was published in 1981. That is all much bigger than that right now. And again, Hoechst is now part of Sanofi. Each of these companies does more business than E.I. DuPont de Nemours, basically DuPont Chemical, with sales of $9.4 billion. The United States is, of course, the major market, one into which these German corporations continue to pour investment money for both new capital construction and corporate takeovers. Together, these three multinationals assure permanent prosperity for the original 450 Farben stockholders, their banks, and the shadowy shareholders of the Bormann Organization in South America, who guard and vote the Hermann Schmitz Trust Fund to intermediaries at the annual meetings of BASF, Bayer, and Hoechst. If there was any doubt in Europe who in the long run won the peace of World War II, there is none whatsoever among the former German leaders dwelling in South America. It is a good bet that if Hermann Schmitz were alive today, he would bear witness as to who really won World War II. Parenthetically, as I have stated, it was the Axis that won, not on the battlefield, but in the corporate boardrooms of the cartels, and that is essential. Bear in mind that the IG Farben cartel was actually hammered together by John Foster Dulles, who became Secretary of State under Dwight D. Eisenhower, while his brother and fellow Sullivan and Cromwell partner, Alan Dulles, ran the CIA and had the Galen organization underneath him at that point in time. One more time, and overlapping with what I've already read. It is a good bet that if Hermann Schmitz were alive today, he would bear witness as to who really won World War II. Schmitz died contented, having witnessed the resurgence of IG Farben, albeit in altered corporate forms, a money machine that continues to generate profits for all the old IG shareholders, and enormous international power for the German cadre directing the workings of the successor firms. He was the master manipulator, the corporate and financial wizard, the magician who could make money appear and disappear and reappear again. Schmitz's whole existence was leisure domain, played out on the game board of IG Farben in his beloved Germany. Their Schmitz and Bormann association was close and trusting over the years, and it is the considered opinion of those in their circle that the wealth possessed by Hermann Schmitz was shifted to Switzerland and South America and placed in trust with Bormann, the legal heir to Hitler. Hermann Schmitz's wealth, largely IG Farben bearer bonds converted to the big three successor firms, shares in Standard Oil of New Jersey, equal to those held by the Rockefellers, as well as shares in the 750 corporations he helped Bormann establish during the last year of World War II, has increased in all segments of the modern industrial world. The Bormann organization in South America utilizes the voting power of the Schmitz Trust, along with their own assets, to guide the multinationals they control, as they keep steady the economic course of the fatherland. And before I read the summation here, bear in mind that the Bormann organization and Heinrich Müller, the Gestapo chief, were grafted basically onto the U.S. The U.S. joined the Axis, basically, even before the conclusion of World War II, and Heinrich Müller went to work for and with U.S. intelligence. Atop an organizational pyramid that dominates the industry of West Germany through banks, voting rights enjoyed by majority shareholders in significant cartels, and the professional input of a relatively young leadership group of lawyers, investment specialists, bankers, and industrialists, Bormann is satisfied that he achieved his aim of helping the fatherland back on its feet. To ensure continuity of purpose and direction, a close watch is maintained on the profit statements and management reports of corporations under its control elsewhere. This leadership group of 20, which is in fact a board of directors, is chaired by Bormann, but power has shifted to the younger men who will carry on the initiative that grew from that historic meeting in Strasbourg on August 10th of 1944. Old Heinrich Müller, chief of security for the NSDAP in South America, is the most feared of all, having the power of life and death over those deemed not to be acting in the best interests of the organization. Some still envision a Fourth Reich. What will never pass is the economic influences of the Bormann organization, whose commercial directives are obeyed almost without question by the highest echelons of West German finance and industry. Quote, "All orders come from the shareholders in South America," unquote, I have been told by a spokesman for Martin Bormann. And again, to really get an understanding of what I'm talking about here, not only reading the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website, but also the other books I mentioned, there is a link to The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben, All Honorable Men by James Stewart Martin, Treason's Peace by Howard Watson Armbruster, The Devil's Chemist by Josiah Du Bois, Germany's Master Plan, The Story of an Economic Offensive by Borkin and Welch, and again, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. It is also very important to understand the role of powerful Wall Street attorneys in the development of the CIA. We've spoken about that in many programs. It is front and center in the series I did earlier this year as the Republican convention was underway. For the record, programs 1146 through 1150, The Space Plane and COVID-19, The Paperclip Legacy. And again, I feel that the Bormann Group will ultimately prove to be the decisive element in human affairs on this planet, and I think the future will be theirs. In another book that is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website, the book Germany Plots with the Kremlin by P.H. Pettens, that by Henry Schumann, hardcover published in 1953, there is the text of an article written by Dorothy Thompson, P-H-O-M-P-S-O-N, writing in the New York Herald Tribune on May 31st of 1940. And this concerns the plans of the German industrialists for post-war domination. And again, they don't feel, as I've said before, they didn't feel it was necessary to invade the U.S. They felt that corporate control would ultimately give them world power. And compare this with the way the world has developed in the years since World War II. Also compare this to Alan Dulles's conversations with Count Max Eugen von Prince Max Eugen von Hohenlohe, who was a representative, not only a member of the Habsburg family, but a representative of Wolfert Schellenberg in charge of overseas intelligence for the SS in World War II, and himself a director of international telephone and telegraph. And they, meeting in early 43, pretty much laid out the way the world was going to take shape. Dorothy Thompson, writing in the New York Herald Tribune of May 31st of 1940, quoted in Germany Plots with the Kremlin by P.H. Pettens, "The Germans have a clear plan of what they intend to do in case of victory. I believe that I know the essential details of that plan. I have heard it from a sufficient number of important Germans to credit its authenticity. Germany's plan is to make a customs union of Europe with complete financial and economic control centered in Berlin. This will create at once the largest free trade area and the largest planned economy in the world. In Western Europe alone, there will be an economic unity of 400 million persons. To these will be added the resources of the British, French, Dutch, and Belgian empires. These will be pooled in the name of Europa Germanica. The Germans count upon political power following economic power, not vice versa. Territorial changes do not concern them because there will be no France or England except as language groups. Little immediate concern is felt regarding political organizations. No nation will have the control of its own financial or economic system or of its customs. The Nazification of all countries will be accomplished by economic pressure. In all countries, contacts have been established long ago with sympathetic businessmen and industrialists. As far as the U.S. is concerned, the planners of the world Germanica laugh off the idea of any armed invasion. They say that it will be completely unnecessary to take military action against the U.S. to force it to play ball with this system. Here, as in every other country, they have established relations with numerous industries and commercial organizations to whom they will offer advantages in cooperation with Germany. And again, the Bush family and the Bush-Walker family, arguably the single most important contact of these industrialists, although they had really many very important contacts, that would, again, Sullivan and Cromwell, Allen and John Foster Dulles, the Ford Motor Firm, profound contacts with Standard Oil and other U.S. oil companies. Reading the book All Honorable Men by James Stuart Martin, it is quite apparent that by the period between the world wars, the nation state per se had been superseded by the transnational corporate state. The nation state had become secondary in importance by the period between the world wars. And when I talk about the Bormann Network, and when I talk about BioNTech and people like Thomas Strumond and the very brilliant and yet low-profile Strumond brothers, that low profile being characteristic of the Bormann Group and one of the reasons for its success. They don't like to make waves. They just acquire power and then make a whole lot of money, and in so doing, they acquire power. And that is basically why I believe they will prove, well, one of the main reasons I think they will prove to be the dominant element in human affairs on this planet. And basically, digressing ever so slightly, well, not really from the Bormann Group, but certainly from a discussion of I.G. Farben, I've spoken about the book Serpent's Walk for many, many years. It is about a Nazi takeover of the U.S. after a genetically engineered virus devastates the U.S., martial law is declared, and the successors to the SS who have infiltrated the army and gained control of the opinion-forming media take over. I've also spoken about the fact that Bertelsmann, the publishing house for the West, for the SS in World War II, and headed up by former SS officer Heinrich Mohn in the World War II and post-World War II periods, dominates English language publishing, and their house historian, a guy named Dirk Babendam, has written books as recently as 1998, blaming World War II on Franklin Roosevelt, U.S. imperialism, and Jewish control of Hollywood and the news media. And that, I think, will in the decades to come, or perhaps 100 years from now, maybe less, become the operant narrative. Why? Because look who is gaining control. Wrapping up with the New York Times business section of Thursday, November 26th of 2020, by Alexander Alter, ALPER, and Edmund Lee, Deal turns book giant into a titan. The biggest book publisher in the U.S. is about to get bigger. Viacom CBS has agreed to sell Simon & Schuster to Penguin Random House for more than $2 billion in a deal that will create the first mega publisher. Penguin Random House, the largest book publisher in the U.S., is owned by the German media conglomerate Bertelsmann, adding Simon and Schuster. The third largest publisher would create a book behemoth, a combination that could trigger antitrust concerns. And again, Bertelsmann, that was the publishing house for the SS in World War II. Heinrich Mohn, who headed that firm up, was SS. And I've noted that his son, Reinhard Mohn, now deceased, Liz Mohn, his widow, runs the company now, I believe. But Reinhard Mohn actually got to pick Dieter Vogel as the head of the board of Thyssen AG, now Thyssen Krupp, indicating the power of Bertelsmann. And Bertelsmann dominates English language publishing, and they will do so to an even greater extent. Also, as we have looked at in past programs, publishing, including periodicals, is also controlled by the Underground Reich and the deadly Bormann Group by manipulating advertising. If a particular periodical does not publishes something they don't like, they withhold advertising. Again, as Dorothy Thompson noted, the Reich felt that political economic control automatically led to political control. And we'll continue with our analysis of world events in our next program because we are all out of time. This concludes For the Record program number 1168, Biopsyop Apocalypse Now, part 24, A Pound of Cure, part 3, being recorded on December 11th of 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.